Good afternoon. Sorry, I didn't mean to make that so hard. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee to order. It is now 1:02 p.m., Thursday, March 9th, and we are sitting in the State Capitol Gruenberg Room, number 120. And present, we have Vice Chair Ledoux, Representative Parrish, myself, Representative Chris Tuck. So not yet do we have a quorum to conduct business, but we do have some presenters that I would like to get started with. The first couple housekeeping things, make sure your cell phones are dialed all the way down, past vibrate to silent. Don't need to turn them off, make sure they're on silent because it can interfere with our recording system. And I would also like to thank Caitlin Ellis here with our house records, Kelsey Goodell in the back, along with Jeremy Don from Media Services to help with our moderating our meeting today. So today we have the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council and presenting here to the committee. And we do have one bill on the calendar after the presentation, House Bill 150, the pay, allowances, and benefits of organized militia members. But first, let's start off with our presentation. If you will, please state your name and affiliation for the record. And Representative Sather just showed up, so we now have a quorum.
Okay, thank you, sir, so very much for allowing us to come into the House and Military and Veterans Affairs Special Committee. I would like at this time to just let the committee, if you don't mind, to introduce themselves. They'll stand and say their name.
I'm Ski Marcinkowski. I'm a member of the Advisory Council. I'm from Fairbanks.
Pleasure, Ski.
Bill Sorrells from Eagle River, and I'm on the
council. Pleasure,
Bill. Phil Hokinson from Fairbanks. Mm-hmm.
Ron
Siebels,
Anchorage.
James
Aitens
from
Wausau. Stephen Williams from Juneau.
Good to see you, Steve. Ron Huffman, no.
Irene Washington, Bethel, council member.
Carrie Pardee from Ames.
Butch Diop, Palmer, council member.
Pleasure.
Swill and Wright Novak, Eagle River, council member, vice chair.
And I'm Pam Beal. Chair from Anchorage. Okay, we have this council consists of 13 members appointed by the governor. One person is appointed to the council from a veterans organization. One or more persons is from the state agency that manages its programs affecting veterans, and one or more persons from the general public who is familiar with veterans issues. The council advises the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs through the governor, other departments, agencies, and state matters concerning state veterans, their dependents, and their survivors. The council makes recommendations to the governor and the department concerning the needs and benefits of for the state's department for developing public and private partnership to see those needs for providing information regarding veterans benefits and services for improving recognition of state veterans and other matters, and holds meetings to establish committees and internal procedures necessary to appropriate these duties. Some of our highlights for AVAC since 2006 to date, here are just a few of accomplishments that the AVAC members have done. Veteran status on the Alaska driver's license and ID cards. If you notice, the veterans, if they say, are you a veteran, there's a little flag on the driver's license that represents to them, to the people that look, that they are a veteran. Purple Heart, Gold Star, and Disabled Veteran License Plate. Education benefits for spouses, dependents, and those that died on active duty. Designated a seat on the AWAB, that's Alaska Workforce Investment Board. And we established a Pioneer Home, which now houses 117 veterans as of March 8th. We participated in several veteran summits across the state of Alaska, which were very well received. And we now have in place a section on a web page, but the for questions that anybody would like to ask this committee. And it will go through Verdi and Mercedes, and then they will in turn give the questions to this committee to take care of the answers. For future plans, this committee is going to continue to monitor VA health care agreement And we also know that as of August 7th, we will not have the choice program as it's been, so it will be some changes going on. That will be done August 7th, 2017. And I understand that some of the gentlemen here, and I'm going to let Phil hit on that here in a few minutes, but he is excellent and knows so much about the choice program and health care. And then we also will have VA benefits that we're going to be looking into and additions, to changes to the state benefits. So at this time, I'm going to let Phil, are you able to speak loud enough?
Sure.
Actually, if we can have Phil approach so we have him on the record with the microphone. And I also want to recognize Representative Sponholz. Thank you. And Phil, if you don't mind, stating your name and affiliation for the record.
Sure. Phil Hokinson, I'm a member of the Advisory Council, the Veterans Advisory Council from Fairbanks, and also work for the VA. So I've had the opportunity to work in the healthcare arena with these programs, particularly the sharing agreements with the tribal healthcare organizations throughout the state, and in the choice program. So the current status of the choice program, as Ms. Beal mentioned, is that we don't know exactly what it looks like after August 7th. I don't know if you have much familiarity with the program, but when the law came into effect, it fenced in the money for the VA and kind of forced the VA's hand in Alaska to use the choice program to purchase care. So over time, we've kind of acclimated to it. There was a lot of trouble implementing it up front, but at this point, we're using it primarily as the way that we purchase care from private health care providers throughout the state. So August 8th, the day after the funding runs out, we don't necessarily know exactly what that looks like, but we know that there's been talk that the Alaska model right now, where our hometown integrated care services, the folks who know the veterans in Alaska, who know the providers and talk to them, they're going to be the ones still interfacing directly with veterans, with providers. They'll be pushing out authorizations to community providers, and then it looks like a contractor will probably still be doing kind of the back end work of paying the bills and doing the claims process. So I don't know. You know, for a fact, that's how it's going to look. But I think it's going to be a relatively painless transition to whatever comes next. So,
okay, and Mr. Hokinson, just real quick, just want to recognize the Representative Rauscher. Welcome to the committee. So, before the choice program was instituted, and obviously that came with some federal funds. How were we previously funding the health care costs or to the contracts that we had?
So how it worked beforehand, in Alaska, the Alaska model is actually what the choice program is essentially based on, where we have a small, really primary care-focused footprint of just one major clinic that's combined with the Air Force Hospital at J-Bear. It's considered a joint venture hospital, but besides that, we just have outpatient clinics, just several other outpatient, Fairbanks, Kenai, Juneau. So how it had worked is we received station funding, and there wasn't necessarily different lines, I guess. So when the choice program came in, there were certain stipulations to using that money, one of them being that the VA would be a secondary payer when we purchased care in the community, and there was money that was basically fenced into that pot. And so we still have station funding. We still nothing's really changed about how we purchase urgent emergent care in the state of Alaska, but it's just, I mean, essentially just a different mechanism where that money is set aside for the CHOICE program. So
thank you.
Yep.
Any questions or comments from committee members?
Here's a question.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Hawkinson, is there a call center for Vets Choice in Alaska, or were they able to move that up here, or is that still outside?
So we recently transitioned the phone lines. The call center had been brought back into Alaska following the debacle with outside employees of the contractor, TriWest, not necessarily understanding all of the specifics of healthcare in Alaska. So we had brought that back. That still exists in that way with regard to purchasing care. But now we have a call tree that actually goes through a regional call center. And that's really focused on freeing the hands of some of our frontline employees who end up, you know, taking sometimes up to 60 phone calls a day, and letting them work on coordinating care, which is, you know, their primary job. So,
You said we have a call tree that goes to a regional call center. Put that in human terms for me. So,
sorry. So when someone calls the VA in Alaska, they're most likely going to be referred to a call center, and I believe it's in Walla Walla. I can't remember the exact location. That might not be correct. And then once that phone operator gets the call, they're going to give a warm handoff to whoever that call needs to go to. So they'll be able to direct it immediately, and that way you don't have frontline staff being tied down as much, and the calls can be more efficiently directed. And, you know, with any change like that, there's going to be some hiccups, and I think the VA has probably been trying to you know, reconcile any issues and fix those problems. So,
good. Thank you. Appreciate mm-hmm. it.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Passed off to maybe a nurse or directly to a provider who, yeah, in Alaska.
Any other questions or comments from committee members? All right. Thank you very much, Phil Hawkinson. Appreciate it.
This morning, this group is also working on resolutions. We have five that are we hope that somebody, and hopefully this group, will pick up and carry forward for us. There's not a lot of dollars involved in any of them, but, you know, we have to have somebody that cares enough to say, sure, I'll take this bill. You bet. I like this. So that's our big key. So we're going to just kind of sit here unless Sue Ellen wants to talk a little bit about the museum.
Sue Ellen, would you like to share?
I do.
And please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Sue Ellen Wright Novak. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Veterans Museum. How many of you knew we had a museum? Okay. Well, that's better than usual. All right, we're doing better. Okay, the museum has been around, the effort's been around for 16 years now, and we have actually been open. It will be 6 years on April the 17th of this year. We will have been open for 6 years. It took 10 years to do a lot of branding and people to realize who and what we were and what we were trying to do, and so that finally came to fruition on Palm Sunday, as a matter of fact, April 17th, 2011. Since then, we have had all kinds of really great things happen to us. We've won a number of awards. We won a Seymour Award from Visit Anchorage for the best community organization. Last year, we won the best community team in Anchorage, which was the Denina Service Award. So that was from the Downtown Partnership. We raised $47,000 on the Iron Dog raffle. We were the most successful nonprofit partner that the Iron Dog had ever had. And we sold, if we sold 700 tickets, we were supposed to get about $50,000. Well, we sold 800 tickets, but thanks to somebody in Fairbanks stealing the second prize, we kind of lost a little money. So it is what it is. We've been very active with various different support groups, various different service organizations. We also are working with the History Channel on a six-part miniseries on the Aleutian Campaign and the Alaska Scouts. We're working with PVF Documentaries on the same thing. And now we have the Discovery Channel knocking on the door for a similar project. We are handling the funds. We're the pass-through 501c3 for the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Dutch Harbor. And that will be out in Dutch Harbor the 2nd through the 4th of June this year. And we hope to have the Discovery Channel and a Japanese film crew over there on this. So we have been extremely active. We actively solicit your membership. It's the best $30 you'll ever spend.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in Anchorage, it's the best $3 you'll ever spend, but that's why you see you need to be a member. Then you don't have to pay. So I would invite any questions. We are in the Blue Marketplace Mall, and it is at the corner of 4th Avenue and Diaz and Delta Street in Anchorage.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sue Ellen.
Yep.
Any questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. How does the, through the chair, Colonel Novak, how does the Veteran Museum fit into the normal visit to Anchorage or South Central Alaska for your typical visitor from outside?
Well, we've done a good job at that, too, because we advertise and market virtually everywhere. And we also are a desired destination for American Legion members. And so that gives them benefits, us a lot of visibility. In the summertime, we're seeing up to 35 guests a day. Now, this time of year, 0 to 2, it's kind of bad. Other than, I did her on Saturday, we had 65 visitors, and we got 71 extra donations because we put a ladder out front so people can crawl up on top to take pictures of the dogs. And we do well at Fur Rondi, too. So.
Representative Sather.
Thank you. I want to make sure that you, I don't know who's making a buck off of the Veterans Museum, if anybody, but I want to give you the opportunity to explain what degree veterans support and volunteers play in the mission of the Veterans Museum.
Well, we are an all-volunteer organization, and so that definitely helps us. It is the veterans that support us the most. It's the veteran service organizations that make sure that we have funding. We do go out for grants, but you must realize that the grants that are nonprofit of our nature can go out and get do not cover operating funds. It can only cover, okay, I want to bring a traveling exhibit up, or I want to build a new exhibit over here, and I can get the money to help to do that. And we've been fortunate. We've gotten money from the Atwood, and we've gotten money from the Rasmussen Foundation, both. But for the most part, it is our veterans that support us. And so that's why we are actively seeking your membership. AlaskaVeterans.org. You can apply online.
One last one. Through the chair, I'm a member.
I know. You were.
I know. Very good. So, and lastly, Colonel, please explain what the situation is with the physical plant. You got a great space and location, but I know you have a lot more exhibition material than you have exhibition space. Talk about your physical plant plans.
Well, we have a very full 1,433 square foot room. It's a very well-packed, L-shaped room. If I were queen, I would take over the entire mall down there, or at least that back end. However, I think we might have a better way of doing this. We are investigating co-locating with the Alaska Aviation Museum, so that we can share resources. We have the expertise then for the museum side itself and the museum studies and conservation. And so we are actively pursuing that. We've passed over the first and second hurdle. Now we are developing the actual proposal. The draft one will be available by April. It will be signed by June, and hopefully we will be moving the middle of October to move out to the Aviation Museum, hopefully.
Thank you. Carry on.
Any further questions? Thank you so much, Sue Ellen, for the update. Appreciate it.
Do you and have any Ms. questions Beale? For this committee?
Any Council? Questions? Well, can you share with us some of your requests for this year? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Sadler.
There's always one more question. I would just sure. like to... Oh, oops, nope. I just confused boards. I apologize. No, I'll back up.
I would like to let Bertie Bowen come up, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Just kind of touch on some of the highlights. And
okay, thank you so much. And Bertie, if you don't mind, stating your name and affiliation with the record.
Thank you, Chair and Representatives. So I'm Bertie Bowen. I'm the Director of Veterans Affairs for the State of Alaska. I provide the administrative support for the board and the financial support for the board as they come to Juneau. And we meet annually in Juneau to review state laws, current state laws that provide benefits for veterans. Also, we also review items of interest that are coming up that veterans have brought to our attention. Say, for instance, like we could use the driver's license identification that Representative Sadler had got passed a few years ago, and the board reviewed that and supported that. We've had the board support things like the Hmong, different issues with the Hmong, different issues that that come up. They're a great research committee to review items of interest for the veterans because the communities that they're from all over Alaska, they bring to us a veteran area specific expertise to the board and to Alaska to allow us to touch those veterans in those areas. Sometimes it's hard to visualize what goes on along the YK Delta unless you've been out there. And sometimes if people don't get out there, they can't quite visualize it. But if you ask Irene Washington, she can tell you instantaneously some of the issues that she faces within the Bethel region. And you can do the same thing with Ron Huffman in Nome, which has a whole different flavor of events. And then as you go into Haines, you have other issues that the veterans will be experiencing there as well. And I see.
Vice Chair Ledoux.
Yes, Bertie. Thank you for mentioning the Hmong community, and I'm wondering what efforts that are being made now by either your group or anyone in Congress to make sure that the Hmong are getting the benefits that they were promised when they were fighting the war in Laos and Vietnam, those Hmong veterans. Who haven't really been formally acknowledged as veterans.
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, what has been done so far in the past is we've had the Hmong license plate, which the AVAC at the time supported, which is Patho Lao, I think is what it says on the license plate itself. Last year, they come forward as a board and did a support for adding the Hmong onto the driver's license as veteran. Those are the two items that they have done so far in recognition of the Hmong. The other items that we haven't gone forth with that we have done out of my office is we've worked through Allegra Hahn in Washington, D.C. in 2012 and 13 to help the Hmong receive the rights of access to burial in federal cemeteries, which has never made it out of committees. I know that Senator Murkowski has brought that forward several times. And those are the kind of items that we try and bring back to the board. And as each year comes through, some of our members on the board will go to the Hmong memorial services that are held in May. And you will see them there as well.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
I could take advantage of the break for questions. Through the chair, Bertie, Mr. Bowen, I'm going to say something delicate. I'm getting old, and so the war that I read in the paper was the Vietnam War, but there have been several conflicts since then, Gulf War, OIF, OEF, the Global War on Terrorism. So are you able in the Veterans Affairs Office to to address the needs of the more recent veterans? Or is there anything helping you or hindering you from doing so?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the biggest hindrance that we have today with the current, and I like to call it the current conflicts, because you can't really put an age of the individual that is fighting. And the reason why I say that is because currently today we have people in Iraq from the ages of 18 to in their 60s, because the National Guard is one of our frontline forces. So when you're dealing with that kind of a force, you can't put an age on it. The issue that we have with returning veterans, a lot of our returning veterans, is that once they get out of the service, it is very hard to get them back into the VA. We almost it's almost like it's a cyclic kind of thing that happened. After Vietnam, the Vietnam veterans did not seek any care, or they did seek care and they were treated poorly. Our veterans today are not treated poorly. They're treated very well, and we really try and reach out to them and do all sorts of different community events to bring them in to enroll. But most of the time, they just don't. And each one in their own way has their own personal reason why they don't do that. But and I can tell you that not all of them are the same. I have an individual that I worked 3 years, and this will give you an example. I worked on an individual for 3 years to get into the VA system. That individual actually paid for the surgery on his leg himself, and it was actually caused by an injury in Iraq. That occurred in Iraq, and finally, after I got him through the system and into the programs, the individual received his disability, and his remark was, "Gosh, I wish I would have done that 5 years ago." Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's you can't really put your finger on why they're not doing it, but I can tell you that it's almost the same verbiage that the Vietnam veterans said. At the end of Vietnam, when they said all the people in the VA are World War II veterans. Mm-hmm. And today I hear people say, well, all the people working in the VA are Vietnam veterans, which is not the truth, because if you look in the VA, they look like all the people that are sitting behind me. It's the ages go from young to old, and they look just like our military today. So, mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Bertie. Appreciate it.
If you allow us a few minutes, I'd like to have some questions from our AVAC members.
Sure.
Do we have any questions?
No, they have locked jaws.
Or any comments, anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah. Never volunteer.
Okay. I knew you would.
I hear a lot of chuckling out there.
To the committee, through the chair, I'm James Hastings. I'm one of the Valley representatives. I'm on the Wasilla side, and my counterpart Butch on the Palmer side. We've been fortunate to be on the Veterans Advisory Council for I think since 2011, and I've seen a lot of really good things happen. One of the greater things, I think, was when we used to have we sort of died off, and I think everything, again, like to use Verdi's word, cyclic. You know, we often have to change focus. Finances will drive the train, or emotions will drive the train. Deployments change things. There's a lot of really great legislation that has taken place here, and there's always going to be more on deck. Some of it is election year legislation, and we are all able to recognize: is it genuine, or is it a vote? Getting piece of legislation, but our body collectively has been able to interface with our community, your constituents, and try to bring you as representative the same thing that you guys are tasked with or have taken on to represent the community as a whole. So we've been real fortunate with getting down in the weeds and not wrapped around Joe Brown has trouble getting his medication. We're not at that level. There's systems to fix that, but we look at the bigger picture. One of the things we look at is the economic stimulus of the Alaskan veteran and the military, transitioning military. We're still at a point that we import labor when we have a work-ready labor force prepared to step out of a uniform and go to work the next day. We work very closely with the Department of Labor at the state and the federal level. We've been able to utilize a lot of the STEP grants outside of just simply the union training. We've been pretty fortunate, Phil, I think, with the UAA program, with working on getting more generous acceptance of the military training for credit. Mm-hmm. But my whole point behind this is we have a workforce, 268 veterans per month in the state of Alaska transition out of some branch or some component. That seems like a pretty astronomical number, but I'm going to hold Verdi accountable for that. I can do that? Okay. Because we had to do those studies, we were working on, you know, what is the effect? What do we have here? Of that workforce, we weekly brief at the ACAP track, the Army Career and Alumni Program, and the Air Force Transition Program. We do weekly briefs there. And on average, when you ask a group of 30-some-odd troops, where are you going to go? What's next? Who wants to stay in Alaska? And about 30% will say, yeah, I want to. And then when you ask how many you're going to, the number cuts in half. When you say, if you had job training and you could afford a home off base and maintain the standard of living that you're accustomed to, how many would stay? And we hit about 70 to 80%. Point behind that, we continue to focus on what we're doing with our state training and employment program grants. We continue to work with the Department of Labor with, currently we're working with, what exactly is the title of that, Steve? The J.D. Neggs?
Training Services.
What's that? Okay, so through them, we're working on some federal grants that are actively taking folks in uniform, identifying their needs and desires, matching them with employers. The employers are making pre-offers, sort of like military enlistment. If you graduate school, you get to go to training. If you graduate training, you get to be in the military. So we work that same process. It's very familiar with the veterans. It gives them an opportunity to forecast and make plans. Now we're seamless transition. If you get out of the military in any branch and you decide you want to go to work, you now have a break. You now have a problem with home financing, with a lot of issues. So we have seamless transition there. The job is lined up and waiting. Now it gives the military the ability to look at it from what's important to the DOD. And I know that it sounds rough, but it's a fact. DOD every year comes up with some sort of a contract to try to assuage unemployment. We don't want to spend money to pay warriors not to be warriors. We want to invest that money into training and equipping warriors. But when we have a huge number of unemployment bills to pay, that's a problem. So if we can head that off, we head it off. It's an emergency room sort of a thought process. Do I stop the bleeding or do I start to mop the floor? Well, we've inherently said, hey, let's work on the veterans. These guys are homeless and helpless and hopeless. We got to take care of them. But before that happens, let's stop that. Let's catch them in the uniform and say, hey, do you want to be an Alaskan for the rest of your life? Because if you do, we've got a plan for you. And that's what the state's doing right now through our own funding and our federal funding. So my encouragement to you is when you see funding that deals with transitional employment, with training, with certification, entrepreneurship, if it leads to making that American citizen an Alaskan resident, you're going to have a great workforce. And now we're no longer exporting our income to Louisiana and other states. We've actually even reversed that. We're working with one of the trucking companies in the lower 48 that does a reverse slope commute. We have truck drivers that now drive 3 weeks on in the lower 48 but live in Alaska. So we begin to look at other methods to continue the economic input. So specifically this committee, never, ever, ever forget what an economic impulse that our veterans and our military are for you.
All right. Thank you very much, James. Appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Representative Sadler, then Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Hastings, I understand you speak also from a workforce development standpoint here, and I'm glad you're in that seat.
Yes, sir.
Have that experience.
And thank you.
Yeah, well, we work together on that. But we picked up some of the low-hanging fruit, and I won't list those things now, but I was going to ask.
Hang on a second. Did y'all hear that?
No.
Okay.
But are there
inside joke, sir.
Two questions? That's okay. I like those too. I understand the big Army and Air Force have plussed up their resumes. I'll call it the military resume.
Mm-hmm.
Is that working well for employees to pick up?
It is. I think one of the things that we've determined working with the with Sherman and other the human resources folks is the onus has been on the veteran to learn to speak civilian, mm-hmm. and the companies that have learned to reverse that role and to begin to staff their human resources departments with folks who can speak military, then not as much of an overlook. A generalist is going, keyword, 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 I don't know what an NCO is, not going to look at them. And they may miss some really qualified personnel. it's easier to teach an HR department how to look at a resume and go, oh, I know what an academy means. That's an important word, and it's not in our search list. So it's kind of reverse engineering, but what they've done is they're getting better at writing civilian resumes, which is important. But again, what we've learned in Alaska, especially working with subcontractors, we had 37 people on the Point Thompson build that were hand-selected, still in uniform, that went through a selected training program and went to work building Point Thompson. And we're starting again with ConocoPhillips on the next ramp-up. They've already contacted us and said, hey, how many do you think you can fill? And I pretty much said, you tell me what you need, and we'll find the right people, and we'll train them, and we'll fill those jobs. So,
well, if I can follow up, I want to give the chairman credit for getting one of the bills through, low-hanging fruit, the veterans preference for private employers, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any things that you might characterize as mid-hanging fruit? What's the next tranche of things we might be able to do for job training for veterans or skill training?
I think one of the things that you'll see come from us, too, is to encourage UAA, because we do fund them greatly, whether that's through the educational side or the TVEP side with the Department of Labor. TVEP is the technical vocational education program. It's the non-degree side of UAA. But I think by leveraging those funds and saying, if you want to receive this level of funds, you have got to be genuine in your acceptance of military training for credit. Just cookie cutting it doesn't work. It has to be an individual breakdown on capabilities and potential of that individual.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Parrish and Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Hastings, for your Hastings, for your work. It sounds like you're doing some excellent service for your fellow veterans. This is a great time for me to meet the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council, because just yesterday I introduced a bill which would direct the state to learn to speak a little bit of military.
Good.
To take into account military experience in hiring and allow that to be a substitute for instance, a four-year degree if it's highly pertinent. So I guess my request of the council is I'd love to work with you on that, to submit it to you and to get your feedback.
I think we'd love to be able to help craft some of that language, and I think that's where we're in an advantage to you, is we do have the background experience. There's collectively a few hundred years of military experience sitting behind this microphone here, all total, at every level of leadership, followership, and expectation. And we want to be a part of this program. We want to be able to look at it line for line. Maybe we don't want a nice sign over a bad road. Maybe you should ask us, do we want a good road to a good school, and we'll put the signs up. So those are things that we'd like to be engaged in, you know. Bounce things off of us. Bounce it through Verdi's office, and it filters back to us. We're all doing our job and able to communicate. And in that vein, I find situations sometimes where we have an individual who can build an entire city from the desert up, but can't get a job as a shift supervisor at Lowe's here.
Yeah.
Because they just can't understand to dumb it down that much. And there's also some intimidation factor as well. But those are good pieces of legislation. And we don't want to touch money. We understand the fiscal issue of this. But again, when I told you we're economic drivers, I want you to consider things like when you look at property tax breaks. There's oftentimes discussion of, well, at the borough level, well, if we give you another $70,000 or $100,000 property tax break, you're going to break the borough. You break the numbers down, it's not. The total sum, roughly, of what, it's not even $10 million. And it seems weird to sit before you and say only $10 million, but I think only does work with $10 million in some cases. When you look at the return on investment, that those veterans will purchase homes and they will stay here and they will raise families, that's easily replaceable funding when you look at the value of keeping us here in the state.
Mm-hmm. For your information, we will be hearing Representative Parrish's bill a week from today on Thursday, so there's an opportunity for anyone who would like to testify. Mm-hmm. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were talking about the need for universities to be truly welcoming institutions, and if I remember correctly, a few years ago when I was at UAA, mm-hmm. we were very proud to be recognized as a military and veterans-friendly institution, and I'm wondering if you still find that to be true and if there's any barriers that you think are yet to be addressed.
I don't often come in contact with a lot of complaints and issues of the universities not working well with individuals, and I don't want to indicate that it's not a good relationship. Mm-hmm. And I also understand that the more generous you are with your accreditation program, the fewer dollars come through the door.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many different things to consider with that. But Verdi, I mean, you're a great point of contact. How many complaints do you actually see?
It's normally from university to university is where the complaints
come. Right. It's
from like UAF to UAS, and it might be the same biology course.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind, Verdi, can you mind put that on the record?
Please.
I'm Verdi Ball. I'm the Director of Veterans Affairs through the chair to represent Spineholes. What generally it is that most of the complaints we get in our office is that we'll have someone that transitions from UAF to UAS or UAA to UAF, and they'll take a biology course. I'm just using that as a generic course, but one university won't accept the other one, and in reality, it's the same book, same syllabus, same everything. It's just a, and I don't know why they do that, but it just causes issues for students when they go from one place to another.
So to clarify, that is one of the challenges with having three separate accreditations, because typically, actually, not everything is exactly the same. It's just different enough. But we're familiar with those kinds of comments about regarding transferability of credits. But in terms of sort of admissions processes, support for veterans once they've been admitted, or for current military students, as it relates to providing appropriate services, is there any concerns?
Through the chair to Representative Beinholtz, the biggest issue that we have with veterans within the universities, it really comes down to their counselors, returns of phone calls, financial departments. It really doesn't come into the classroom side. It's generally where we run into a lot of problems is processing GI Bill payments,
mm-hmm.
Getting all of the credits or getting the proper documents from the university back to the VA. And what we have done in my office is just recently we have added and we've actually expanded Mercedes Angerman's job title, if you will, to add the state approving agency so that she can actually help with the education process in the state to maybe help reduce some of those issues that we're having between the university and the VA.
Fantastic. Thank you.
And then I'd also like to add that I serve on the trustee board for the Alaska Electrical Apprenticeship School. I'm proud that we have the Helmets to Hard Hats program. I know that some of that's been waning back a little bit, unfortunately, but we still have in our standards to accept military students and their special provisions. And we do recognize their DD-214. Some of it's a little bit hard to transition for state licenses, but for purposes of getting to our apprenticeship program and then continuing on with their education to get their license, you know, we take a lot of that credit on behalf of that. And I just want to say that our motto, our three pillars, is attitude, skills, and knowledge. And the military personnel that come in from the Helmets of Hard Hats program or even outside the Helmets of Hard Hats program come with those three pillars already well established, and so it doesn't take much to bring them up. And when they come through the apprenticeship program, they tend to be the leaders, the foremen, the ones that are project managers, straight out of the apprenticeship program. So, just a plug for the reasons why we need to have veterans hiring preference. The reason why we need to have programs like this is because of the skills, the teamwork, not only the teamwork, but their ability to adapt, their ability to make decisions is very valuable in the workplace.
Sir, Pam Billigan, I would like to have Ron Siebels come up and just talk briefly about the Pioneer Home.
Hello, my name is Ron Siebels. I'm from Anchorage, and I've had the pleasure to work with several of you over the years in different things, especially Kendra Kloster back there, lovely young lady in the back corner. I've, I met several years ago, and she's always been such a jewel to work with. She don't just talk. She does things, and I appreciate that. And I don't know what they pay her, but it's not enough. That's my personal opinion. Anyway, two things. First of all, I want to congratulate all of you. I work on veterans issues at a national level in several capacities. I can tell you other states out there do not get the support from their veterans legislators that Alaska is fortunate to have. And I want to thank you for that because I see it personally. And some of these guys, they really struggle. They can't get what they fairly deserve. But in Alaska, we do have ears that listen. And we do have a lot of veterans up here to vote. And, I mean, you're all aware of that. But not to take advantage of that, I think a thank you is in order from guys like me. So, personally, I want to say thank you. Now let me change hats for a second, okay? I also serve on the Pioneer Home Board. I would respectfully request that when you have time, please spend some time in those homes. We've had several invites for things, and some people have shown up, and some have been busy. And I don't want to throw stones at anybody, but please take the time to go out there. Every one of those homes has veterans in them. And there's some real caring people out there. They don't say a lot. They don't complain. They don't make phone calls. But they care. And we're all going to be there someday. And I just like it. When you have time, go out there and talk to the residents. Not just the veteran, but talk to the residents. I think that's an important thing in the state of Alaska, our pioneer homes. I think it's a much-needed asset. I wish we had more of them. I wish we had more money to fund their staff and keep all their staff on board. But I think it's an important thing in Alaska. And it's a key thing for our state. It gives us a good name. And anything you can do to help that, please do so.
Thank you very much, Mr. Siebels. Appreciate it. Any comments or questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Bill Chair. I wish we had time for you to get to know each of the members here. They are all outstanding. They have such a heart for veterans and military. And we don't have the time to just let you see the passion that each of these members have for in this council. But we thank you very kindly for letting us come into your weekly meeting and tell you a little bit about us.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the service that you provide and your dedication and your volunteerism, serving Alaska Veterans Advisory Council. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Pam, I just want to ask the question that you maybe like to hear. Just what's the main takeaway? What could we do for the Veterans Council, Veterans Advisory Council, that would be the most beneficial to you?
The most beneficial when we bring our resolutions to you, mm-hmm. that each of you would be kind enough to take one. We only have five, so one of you get to draw the short straw. But no, seriously, if you would just take that and say, wow, they have a passion for this. Today we sat, we changed, and we took out a couple that we knew that, okay, we're not going to work on this. And I think, again, just having support to take a bill forward, to take that resolution and say, you know, they care about this. It's going to help veterans. It may not be, you know, something of dollar value, but it's a value to each of us as a veteran and each of the military members. So that's what I would ask you to do.
Appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks for being here today. And you're here for how long?
Till tomorrow.
Till tomorrow. Okay. All right. Sounds good. So if you get a chance, come by and visit our offices. Thank you so much. All righty. Next on the agenda, we have House Bill 150. And this said, just take a quick at ease for everybody to socialize for a quick moment. And so we're taking a quick at ease. Okay, let's come out of recess. I'd like to call the House Military Veterans Affairs Committee back in order. Okay, now before us, we have House Bill 150. House Bill 150 would authorize the same pay, allowance, and benefits for the organized militia, whether they were called into state active duty by the governor or adjutant general, or called to service under federal active duty by the president. I don't know if we have Commissioner Dole online. Doesn't look like it just yet. Just checking to see if committee members have any other questions, any amendments, or any comments.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be good cop and bad cop first. I do protest this being introduced as a committee bill. I think the process was not quite according to Hoyle. That said, I do think it's a decent bill. And I also appreciate the finance reference and the indeterminate fiscal note. And I wish I were on the finance committee still. I got some questions about the costs. But I'll give this to my friends in the finance committee. Thanks.
Okay, and we did go over the costs a little bit, Representative Sadler. And I'll just do a quick review. One of the problems that we have with trying to come up with a fiscal note is, or a determinate fiscal note, is that we don't know what kind of natural disasters we may have in the future. However, the department did give us a spreadsheet, and hopefully you have that with you. If not, I can pass you mine. And it shows the, for example, the 2015 Sockeye fire, and then what those wages would have been underneath the old system, a system which requires the department to have to classify any type of activity that someone from the organized militia is performing underneath a call by the governor, and they have to classify that per what other state employees are doing across the state. So then they get paid according, so they can have as many as 8 different pay scales in one day due to the fact that they have to classify all the different duties that a person does in response to a natural disaster or fire. And so this simplifies things for them, and so they show the old system and the new system, and it really came down to the old system being $30,681.93 to where underneath the new system that's being proposed to try to simplify the administrative procedures on that to $31,046.33. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I want to make sure that we can identify the column headers for – is this – I'm going to be a little facetious. This is not pay per. For example, looking under Sockeye Fire for the corporal, pay service $182.73. Is that per hour, per day, per entire deployment? Help me understand the units.
Let's see.
Days.
Those are the days. So they were paid. So which one are you looking at? So I can give you the
top
example.
One under 2015 Sockeye Fire corporal 0-3, 11 plus years of service. So that would be $182.73 per day.
Per day times 11.
Okay.
Equals $2,010.
Okay, so it would be an extra 17 some dollars under the new system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Further clarification, Mr. Chair?
Representative Swanholtz.
Yeah, I ran the math on it, and the net increase in terms of actual salary paid, representative salary between the old model and the new model using the Sockeye Fire example, the 2015 Sockeye Fire example, was $364.40. That does not take into account the administrative cost savings that they described that would take place as each individual guardsman or militia member would not have to document multiple changes in work duty throughout the course of any given day. And then, of course, obviously the administrative staff as well wouldn't have to change the administrative assignment for the workload in the given day. So it seems pretty intuitive to me that it would be a net zero once you incorporate in those the administrative simplicity that would be implemented.
Okay, and then if I may also let everybody know that we do have Bob Dole, the Deputy Commissioner for Military and Veterans Affairs, online, and we also have Brian Duffy, who is the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. So, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I recall my old chemistry teacher who said, always label your numbers, so I just want to make sure. Also, in the lower left-hand of that same sheet, there are columns name, rank, and what if 4-plus years. So if you can, I understand the ranks, but what does the what if 4-plus years mean?
If you will, Brian Duffy, if you heard the question, we have a chart that was given to us at our last committee meeting regarding the 2015 Sockeye Fire. And just the question is I think it's their experience per individual person. But it looks like, for example, the first person was 11-plus years of service. Is that correct, Mr. Duffy?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Brian Duffy, yes, sir, that is correct. Over.
Okay. So, Mr. Duffy, lower left-hand corner of that same sheet, we've got three columns, name, rank, and what if 4-plus years. Is that just assuming 4 years service of each of those grades? For example, an 04 would be $189.44 per day if they have 4 years experience in that rank. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct. So if you take, for example, Captain Dennis Barrett, the top the top column. He's a captain, grade 03 in normal military vernacular, yep. And had 11 years of service, over 11 years of service. So that rate that showed in the new column was based on that rank and that level of experience. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other further questions? Any other comments? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a good bill. I think it lifts an administrative burden both from the state and from the individual militiamen who've got better things to be doing than checking their watches before and after fighting a fire to estimate the amount of time that they're spending on a given task. So I'm all in favor of this, and thank you for being so gracious as to share the credit through the committee bill form.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. I also want to do a final comment. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, yes. And I just want to get this in the record, too. So this is indexed to the federal pay levels. So if there is an increase in the DOD-wide payment for an E-1, that will also be reflected in the pay here.
That's correct.
Okay, good.
That's my understanding as well. I just want to also comment that I know from being a foreman out on construction jobs that, you know, we have different duties that we do out on a job site. And when we were bought out by a Native corporation, they made us spell out each one of those duties and what we were doing and keeping time for from installing conduit, from trenching, from pulling wire to making terminations. And boy, was that, for a foreman, boy, did that take a lot more of my time away from actually supervising the work out there, just filling out paperwork. So I can't imagine how much more efficient the department will be able to perform based on having to you know, do these detailed time cards and then all these variable pay scales. So what is the will of the committee?
Representative Tuck, Chair Tuck, I make a motion to move House Bill 150, version 30, LS0365/A, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing no objections, House Bill 130, version A, with no amendments, passes with attached fiscal notes from the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee.
You determine it.
Okay, if everybody will stay, pardon me?
Indeterminate fiscal notes?
Oh, it's indeterminate, it was indeterminate fiscal note. Okay, so our next hearing will be Tuesday, March 14th. At that time, we will hear House Bill 152 relating to the authority of the Adjutant General. This is another Title 26 reform brought to us by the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And please stick around to sign the bill paperwork. We stand adjourned at 2:07 p.m.